Welcome to Season 9, Episode 33 of the Ubuntu Podcast. This is not the second time I've done this evening. It's Tuesday, the 11th of October, and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and community. I'm Martin, and joining me this week are Mark.
Hello!
Hello, how are you doing?
Not bad for the first time.
Good. Alan.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
First time. Yes. Good.
And
thank you.
And Emma.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, hello. Thank you for joining us. So, Emma, tell us, who are you and where are you from and how did you come to be here?
I'm Emma. I work at System 76 and I am the leader of the Colorado Ubuntu group. And I do sales support and customer service here.
Yeah. And we put out a plea for help, and you were the first person to reply. So consequently, you're the first guest presenter for the remainder of this season. So that you and a cast of others will be following on. So
I'm honoured.
We're delighted to have you here with us.
Yes, so it means that we've got to speak a little bit less.
Hopefully. So Alan, what have you been up to since last time?
I've been playing with Raspberry Pis.
Have you? Yes. That's interesting. That's not what I thought you'd say.
No, I know.
Have you been using ZFS on the Raspberry Pi by any chance? No, okay.
I found a guide to using a Raspberry Pi Zero connected via just one cable to the computer, via USB
Ooh.
Cable.
Oh.
And it boots up off the SD card. And then connects over Ethernet over the USB cable. So you can SSH to the Pi Zero. Given that the Pi Zero has no Ethernet, no Wi-Fi, you can SSH into the Pi Zero over the USB cable. And the Pi Zero can get access to the internet through the USB cable through your laptop. It's brilliant.
And another really cool thing I saw you can do is you can install a VNC server on the Pi Zero. And then you can VNC or whatever into the Pi Zero's desktop from your laptop or desktop.
Yes,
so it's
indeed.
Like it's like a second computer. It's
yes.
so clever.
It's
this
brilliant.
Does sound fantastic and explains why you can't buy them for love nor money because they're so popular.
Yeah, it's really cool because you only need one cable. Like if you look at all the kits for using a Raspberry Pi, they're generally you've got an HDMI cable and an HDMI adapter, and then you need a USB cable to power the thing and another USB cable and a USB to go adapter so you can plug a keyboard into it and all that faff. Whereas this, like one USB cable plugged into the middle port, the USB port that provides power and data, and you're done.
That's great.
It's really easy to set up and it's really cool.
Nifty. So, Emma, you weren't here last time, so can you tell us what you've been doing recently?
I just finalized the plans for the Colorado release party for Ubuntu 16.10. So we're hoping to have at least 50 to 60 people this time. It's wow. usually a pretty big party. We do geek trivia, and then we give out prizes, and we get some
like loads of fun,
awesome catering, and nice dinner and drinks for people right after work on a Friday.
Wow, so, that sounds brilliant! Come over to your party.
Definitely.
It's a lot to put together, so I'm
it's
happy
than the
that
back room at a pub you get around here.
Oh, well, it's fun. That's all.
Excellent.
Well, should we get on with it?
Yep.
Yes. And now it's time for the news. And first up in the news this week, Yahoo has been using specialized software to allow the NSA to spy on its users.
When you say using specialized software, did they not create that specialized software for spying on their users?
Oh, yes, this okay. Is, they, yes, yeah. Supposedly they've created this specialized software and it's basically been letting US government agencies search users' email in case they're terrorists or something.
Hmm.
I wonder what their most common search term is.
Oh, that would be good. Oh, if there's one thing I want to see on WikiLeaks this year.
Yeah, a tag that. Cloud of that. That would be good.
Yeah,
I'm
so
just imagining that now, that's brilliant.
Yeah, words you know. To avoid in your email all the time.
Yeah. Wow.
So has there been any repercussion of this thing?
Well, a Yahoo spokesperson said that the original Reuters article was inaccurate. They actually said that the article was misleading and that Yahoo narrowly interpret every government request for user data to minimize disclosure. But they were going to say that. And then the likes of Google and Microsoft and Twitter have all been quick to say they've never received such requests and wouldn't comply with them anyway and all that sort of thing. Although Twitter's is a little bit more lukewarm. That seems to, if you read it between the lines, kind of implies that maybe they have had a request, but not quite like this one.
I can't imagine any of them haven't, to be honest. I mean, there's such vast amounts of data.
To be fair with Twitter, if you want to search what everyone has ever said on Twitter, you don't need a special tool to do it.
Not really, no.
You could use Google or Yahoo.
Or search.twitter.com.
Right.
But considering what Yahoo's stance has been in the past regarding fighting, you know, privacy overreach, this is a bit disappointing, and it does make you wonder just if you can actually believe any of the claims that these other organisations are not doing the same or similar.
Yeah,
I've got no confidence in that.
Well, it certainly seems to have affected their value, because there's been rumblings of a buyout by Verizon for a while.
Yeah, and, because Yahoo are worth so much money at the moment.
Well, you know, they're still worth a few billion dollars.
They're worth about $1 billion less now, according to Verizon, though. They want a revaluation in light of not this particular issue, but the loss of 500 million user accounts that we talked about a couple of shows ago.
It's somewhat opportunistic by Verizon, perhaps.
Well, who'd blame them?
Yeah, okay.
They claimed that they weren't aware of that leak at the time that they were engaging in these conversations.
Of course not. What's next on the news?
Well, we have Facebook launching its marketplace to take on eBay and Craigslist. And this is a great idea. I really like it. I'm wondering if they're charging people to sell or not, since it's already been something people do. So I don't understand what their, I don't know what their goal is for this or how.
I guess their goal is not let people sell stuff elsewhere, but make it super stupidly easy to do it on Facebook.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, my wife's face is permanently bathed in the blue glow of Facebook as it is. And if there's one more reason to stay on Facebook, then she will. I guess that's the objective here, isn't it? Keep people on Facebook.
I mean, basically anywhere that you live, you can search for items for sale in wherever. And there's a group of just people saying, here's a thing, buy it, please.
Right.
So I guess this is just kind of formalizing that and maybe making sure
they get some slice of the revenue. Because right now, like any of those groups, people just buy stuff and Facebook don't see any of the money. I mean, obviously they see the hits on those and the fact that you're clicking on, you know, baby shoes and prams
and
stuff. They can tune their advertising for you.
I mean, that's the real value to them, isn't it? Surely knowing what things you're interested in buying.
Well, it'd be cool too if they let consumers, just everyday people, advertise their stuff at a lower cost or something to get it to share, like, in the area more. I think that would be cool.
I don't know how many users eBay has. I mean, it's clearly a lot, and the same with Craigslist, but people are already looking at Facebook 24/7. Meaning that, you know, putting stuff people want to sell right in front of you. So there's no reason for you to leave and go to eBay or Craigslist. Why would you bother when, you know, your trusted friends in your, you know, your friend circle, your social graph can sell you stuff? I can see why it's compelling and why people would jump on it straight away. I mean, there's already, like you say, plenty of...
Yeah, certainly some of the groups and communities that my wife's a member of, she doesn't necessarily know everyone in person, but they have come to know one another and they have common interests. And if they were able to trade items between themselves, then they would certainly do that, because there's already sort of a trust relationship that's been formed there.
Yeah, safer, for sure.
The thing I don't like about Facebook, those sales thing, is, I don't know, it feels often like people sell all kinds of just awful rubbish. And I know, you know, one person's rubbish is another person's treasure. But I don't know. It just feels like the stuff you could buy on eBay is, I don't know, maybe it's just that they surface the stuff that's good on eBay. And all I ever seem to see in these things is awful
stuff
rubbish.
That would be on FreeCycle.
Maybe. Maybe anyway. I'm just not looking hard enough. I'm not in enough of these groups. Maybe that's it.
So, in order to combat this rubbish on the internet for sale, Amazon has banned reviews that have been posted in exchange for free products, which I'm delighted to see that they're doing this.
Well, yeah, it seems a bit
of a
no-brainer.
I've seen a few products that I've bought recently where I've read the reviews and then it's the very last line that says, disclaimer, yeah, I was sent this to review. And I'm like, oh, well.
Yeah, no, they stick out a mile because they're generally positive. They always seem to have photos attached. And what happens is that I find that these are diluting the honesty of the reviews. And the one thing I find most useful about Amazon is when I'm looking at products is to actually look at the impartial views of other people who are interested in that thing to determine whether or not it's suitable for me. And I find that these, you know, sponsored reviews are really annoying and misleading.
See, that going back, this kind of makes me think about the Facebook one that we just mentioned. One of the things that you don't get on eBay is you don't get people leaving comments on products. You know,
yeah.
People can ask questions, but it's up to the vendor to choose whether to show that.
Yep.
Whereas on...
Yeah.
Facebook.
They are actually kind of trying to encourage that now, I think. They're trying to make it a bit more like a shop front where people, when you buy something which isn't just a one-off auction, you do kind of get a thing saying, do you want to leave a review of this?
Right. But those are reviews. On the Facebook side, you often see people leave really quite nasty comments. The comment area underneath products can be pretty awful on Facebook. So anything that can improve that, whether Amazon, yeah, eBay, or Facebook, seems like a good idea to me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Moving on, BitTorrent Inc. has abandoned efforts in its BitTorrent Now streaming service. The two co-CEOs brought in April to drive the company's new focus have been fired. And the company's Los Angeles studio has also been closed, and rumors are, amid rumors, spending was out of control, in inverted commas.
I never even heard of this service.
No, this is obviously another brilliant scheme by BitTorrent Inc. to fail completely.
Right.
Not that I'm bitter about my previous interactions with the company or anything.
Oh, was this when you tried to do a BitTorrent indicator?
Mm. Yes. Oh, I did a BitTorrent indicator and it worked very well.
Sorry,
and
I didn't mean to imply you couldn't do it. You were trying and you were
failing. Then they said, oh, we're going to do an API, and released it with a license that basically said you can't do anything open source with it. Everything is a secret.
Sucks.
Yeah.
I mean, BitTorrent's dead to me anyway because it's closed proprietary nonsense. So I don't particularly care too much. But it seems weird that was it Bram Cohen, the guy who started BitTorrent and came up with these, you know, this new method for distributing files, which, you know, is great, but it's a shame that they couldn't monetize what they were doing.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Mm.
Next up, the developer of Dash, a Snowdkippit. Oh, dear. Code Snippet Manager for Mac OS, as it's now called, has had their software removed from the App Store and their iTunes account closed after allegations of review manipulation.
After allegations?
Yes.
Not evidence.
The developer's side of the story is that basically they used their credit card to set someone else up an account at some point in the past, and that account has been linked to review manipulation, and therefore their account has been assumed to also be part of the same review manipulation and closed. And they were trying to sort it out with Apple. And essentially they were told they had to publish a blog post admitting some wrongdoing, which they said no, because they hadn't done anything wrong. And then they got to an agreement that they would just post their side of the story. And then an Apple spokesperson said, oh no, they've been doing review manipulation and it's all gone a bit unpleasant.
Mm. Open source people.
A man from Cardiff has appeared in court charged with terrorism offences. The charges included such dangerous things as researching an encryption program.
Uh-oh.
Developing an encrypted version of his blog site.
Oh, and don't like where this is going.
And publishing the instructions around the use of the program on his blog site. Also, possessing a USB cufflink that had an operating system loaded onto it for the purpose connected with the commission, preparation, or instigation of terrorism. So basically, an encrypted Linux installed.
Terrorist OS.
I think it's called Tails. Yeah, you might attract a little bit of attention if you call it Terroros or something.
But yes, this phrases like encrypted version of his blog site, does that mean he was serving his blog over HTTPS?
Well,
and is that terrorism now?
That's what I was wondering.
It could be, but equally it could be, you know, over SSL with some kind of encrypted, you know, volume behind it. Once you sign in, you see it, and if you sign out, you don't. You know, it's not especially clear.
Well, was the blog teaching people how to be terrorists or...
Well, according to the charges, the blog was teaching them how to use encryption software.
To be a terrorist or just to use it in general?
It's not clear. He's being accused of doing it to be a terrorist.
Oh.
Some of the other charges are more terrorism specific, but this charge just appears to be he's telling people how to use encryption software.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think the Ubuntu wiki could probably cut.
Shouldn't we all go to jail then?
Yeah.
The views of Emma do not necessarily reflect the views of the Ubuntu podcast.
Sorry. All right. So moving on.
What's next in the news?
So Chrome, everyone knows how much of a hog Chrome is on your RAM. So their December update will be less of a memory hog, finally. They're going to have an updated JavaScript engine that uses 50% less memory than in Chrome 53. So I guess the idea for this is to help users that target users that have 1 gig or less of RAM.
Yeah.
Wow.
And probably all those people
have 8 gigs of RAM and
as well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is like 2 gigs, 4 yeah. gigs. What's that? That's 2 tabs, 4 tabs. Is that how they equate these days?
Yeah, it's crazy how many tabs I have open all the time, and Chrome does not help that at all. So I'll be excited for that change.
Yeah, and it's an impressive achievement as well. 50% less is brilliant. If that's actually what they deliver, then that'll be terrific. And Chromium will benefit as well, I assume.
Oh, yeah. Is it an open source JavaScript engine? Mm. If they got a proprietary one they're going to bundle in there? Or is
I'd assume this was just improvements to V8. That also means like Node and Electron apps and everything else would benefit. But it could be that this is a Chrome-specific proprietary unpleasantness, which wouldn't be brilliant.
And apocalyptically, the Large Hadron Collider is running out of disk space. For those of you that don't remember, the Large Hadron Collider has the potential of opening up a singularity in Europe. So we really don't want this thing to run out of disk space.
I don't think that opening a singularity is the consequence of a disk
full sure, because the Large Hadron Collider runs Linux, and I've seen what happens to large servers when they run out of disk space.
Can I just point out that describing the Large Hadron Collider as a thing that could generate a singularity is, like, slightly disingenuous?
Well, I don't know. It has the potential.
Okay, then. How's that job on the Daily Mail working for you?
Very well, apparently.
Yes. Okay, well, send your old iPods and stuff to the people at CERN so they can plug it in and do their backups, I guess. And now it's time for community news and events. And first up, I plucked this one in. It's an email from Roger Light, who posted to the Bitfolk users list, Bitfolk being a sponsor of this podcast, where he outlined how he migrated from 32-bit to 64-bit without doing a reinstallation. And given our previous conversations we've had on previous episodes about the potential for 32-bit Ubuntu going away and the pain of reinstalling in order to move from 32-bit to 64-bit Linux, I thought this would be a useful thing to put in the show notes and get more awareness of.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
No, neither did I until I read that. I mean, I've heard of people talking about, oh, no, you don't do it. You just reinstall. I mean, technically it's possible and you could do this, scratching their beard and staring into the middle distance. But yeah, apparently it can be done. You can do it. And this guy did it and wrote it down, which was very good.
Excellent.
The Mir display server developers have published a Google Doc discussing what Mir version 1 will look like. And we'll have a link to that document in the show notes.
What's in it then?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me this. I've only just opened it. I have absolutely no idea.
This is basically talking about things like having a stable ABI and what APIs it's going to communicate with and so on. And basically, you know, what they're going to need to constitute calling it Mir version 1.
Right, so the features and stability and APIs that are going to land to make it a 1.0.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't go into big sort of specifics about these are the features we're going to have. It's more of a sort of abstract is if we're going to get, yeah, if we're going to call this 1.0, we need to stop breaking these things every time we do an update.
Right.
Awesome.
Yeah. Next up, the Arch Linux Adapted for WSL project has released its first developer preview.
What's that then?
So this is, you know, you've got Ubuntu for Windows, which runs on the Windows subsystem for Linux.
Yeah.
So this is Arch running on the Windows subsystem for Linux.
Ah, right.
So it's initially targeting Windows 10 in place of Ubuntu on Windows, but they have the lofty goal that version 1.0 will support all versions of Windows using the various subsystems and general sort of Unixy, Linuxy support that's available on the different versions.
Given Microsoft are basically disowned versions of Windows before Windows 10 as if they were a naughty child, they only seem to care about Windows 10.
So is this something that you install through the, for one, I'm not sure what it's called, but like the Windows Store, because that's how you get Ubuntu, right?
It sounds like I think it sounds like you install the Windows subsystem for Linux and then you download a .bat file and run that and it gets you up and running.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's on GitHub and you can try it out.
Well, can we move on for the Skype subject?
We can.
Okay. So this is one of my favorite support topics. Not so much, actually. but this is promising. But there is a catch. So Skype for Linux Alpha can now make Linux to Linux video calls. The catch is the other person has to be on the Linux Alpha as well.
That's brilliant.
But the people that I deal with, the people they're Skyping are on Windows. So I don't know how much this is going to help right now, but just the lack of having to deal with the blue screen, the green screen, and the flicker is going to make my life a lot easier. So
when you say the other person needs to be on the alpha, does that mean the alpha on Linux, or can they be on this new version of Skype but on Windows?
It's the alpha on Linux, and also they've constrained it to be specific versions of the alpha on Linux. So if you've got older versions of the alpha, they won't work at all.
Oh, that makes sense. You know, because it hasn't got the, you know, the bits to do it. That's fair enough. But you know, if you're running the Skype alpha, so there's two entirely separate teams, as I understand it. There's two entirely separate teams at Microsoft making Skype. There's the old school Skype, which was the one that we used to have that just worked everywhere, and the Linux version got old very quickly and all the others were much newer. And then there's this new version, which is a new, different, separate team who've made this new Skype, and the two things are not compatible with each other.
Yeah. And the rumor is that Skype for Linux Alpha could well become what Microsoft are going to call Skype for Life. And they're going to ditch a lot of the other native clients for this Electron version, and they will coalesce around this code base for more of the cross-platform stuff.
So right now it's not great because not everyone can use it, but this will be the future of Skype, and we got hopefully. It first, right?
Hopefully, yeah.
It is a step in the right direction for sure.
Yes. I mean, is there any way you can, you know, if you've got your customers who are calling you and saying, I want to Skype someone, but they're not using Skype Alpha for Linux, you can say, well, give us their phone number and we'll sell them a System 76 laptop, and that will fix that for them.
That'd be awesome. That would be super awesome. But right now, I'll probably have to stick to sending them an article on how to do it.
Moving on, OMG Ubuntu, everyone's favorite Ubuntu blog, posted a poll asking, will you upgrade to Ubuntu 16.10 next week? And of the 6,500 or so people who voted, 42% said yes, they would upgrade to 16.10. 37% said no, and 21% said maybe.
I'm really surprised by those numbers.
Yeah.
What did you think they would be?
I thought practically nobody would upgrade and almost everyone would stay on the LTS.
I thought so too.
Yeah. And I mean, if you add together the no's and the maybes, I mean, that is a greater number. If the maybes are erring on the nose, or even
but
half
not,
of the maybes.
Not as significant as I thought it might be. If you do, right, you know, aggregate no and maybes, even so, it's looking like 60-40 split, which is still far more than I would have thought. I'm pleased to see that a lot of people do want to move to the new version. That's really interesting to me.
Yeah.
I know we have some idea of what versions people are on, and typically people are quite sticky on the LTS releases. They do stay on 1204, 1404, and 1604 historically. But
yeah. Do you have any insight in how people stick with versions with their System 76 machines, Emma?
It's mostly businesses that stay with the LTS. The people that call us to ask us if they should upgrade, we generally have them go to the most current release because that's what we actively test. But right, this runaround, I think we're going to be recommending staying with the 16.04 for just a little bit longer.
Good idea. I usually stick on the LTS until I go to some company event and someone sitting next to me has got something new and shiny. And they go, hey, Alan, you should upgrade. And then I upgrade, and then I immediately regret it because I much prefer the stability of an LTS release.
But don't you always have something running the plus one release?
No, not anymore.
Oh, you've changed, man.
I know, right? I used to, but I tend to stick on the LTSs now, which makes me happy anyway.
Well, we'll continue to offer both options. So, I mean, we'll be offering them probably by the end of the week, but for right now, I'm sticking with 16.04 personally.
Yeah, high five, 16.04.
Dustin Kirkland has posted a blog about a parody within a parody as a result of him watching Saturday Night Live use his Hollywood program, which we've spoken about in the past, to parody Mr. Robot.
This was quite cool.
Yeah, this is really fun.
You just have to read it because it's quite nice. Because, you know, the fact that he's made something that's been used in like news articles and TV shows and stuff is quite funny. But then the fact that it's being used for the express, you know, reason it was created for is to parody the kind of hacker screens with loads of stuff flickering. And they actually used it for that purpose was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Also, good eyes for spotting it in the background of the scene, because I couldn't spot that. It was too dark.
I missed that one. So Nathan Haynes announced the winners of the Ubuntu 16.10 Free Culture Showcase. There's a bunch of wallpapers up on Flickr. We have a link posted there. And then the winners are on Nathan Haynes' live journal.
Cool.
There's some really neat pictures of a lot of landscape photography this year. But I like this one. It was called Alien Wing. And I saw the name first, so I was like really curious to see what it was. And it was like the close-up of a plant or something, but it looked pretty neat. So sweet. I'm probably going to download that one.
Yeah, some really nice stuff there.
Yeah.
Cool. Next up, the Ubuntu Insights blog has an interview with the Krita or Krita developers. Krita, this is Krita. This is the... do you keep correcting me? Am I saying it wrong every time?
Krita.
Krita. I'll get there eventually. The Krita developers. So this is the sort of artistic image manipulation program, which is it part of KDE? I think it is.
Yeah. Well, it's not part of KDE necessarily, but it sits on top of the KDE stuff.
Right. Yes. So they've been interviewed about packaging with snaps. And I haven't read the interview.
Yeah, they just talk about their experience with doing that. And if you're interested in snapping a large application, it's probably a good thing to read to get your head around what's involved.
Excellent. Should we move on to the events before we run out of time?
Yes.
Cool. Well, the first event is the first Ubuntu, not Ubuntu any, at all, nothing to do with Ubuntu, the first LibreOffice 5.3 bug hunting session.
Smooth.
So LibreOffice is approaching the 3.5 release.
Or 5.3.
5.3 release. Dear me. And so this is the first bug hunting session they're doing. They're doing two dedicated sessions, one to chase bugs in the four main LibreOffice modules and the second to test the top 10 features. And
I think this is brilliant.
Yes, yeah, great.
It's a really cool kind of thing.
Yeah, I like the fact that they've got very specific things, like test these four things and test these top 10 features in a very fixed, tight window.
Yeah.
So they can get a lot of good feedback and the people can hang around on IRC or wherever and, you know where to give their feedback. Brilliant.
It's a great idea.
Next up is Retro Gaming Vintage Computer Day, which is on the 24th of October at 11 o'clock. And it's at Flutterby's Tea Room and Coffee Shop in Great Yarmouth, Norfolk. It's a day where you can drop in and play on a range of old computers and consoles and things.
Excellent.
Fun. The Ubuntu Online Summit is coming up. It's November 15th through the 16th, and we'll have a link with details posted.
Yep. If you want to schedule your own event, your own sessions at UOS, you can find out how to do that in the article we will link to.
Cool.
And last up, it's UbuCon Europe, the very first European Ubuntu conference. It's 2 days full of talks, workshops, demos, exhibitions, and hopefully some great food. It's taking place at the Imperfect House in Essen, Germany on the 18th to the 20th of November. You can find more at ubucon.org.
Great.
We love getting your feedback, so please send it to us. Even the pointlessly mean stuff makes us laugh. If it's short, tweet us on @UbuntuPodcast. If it's less short, but please no essays, email us on show@ubuntupodcast.org. If you'd like to discuss some of the things we talk about with other listeners, post on our shiny new subreddit at reddit.com/r/UbuntuPodcast. Or you can just leave a comment on the relevant show notes on our website, ubuntupodcast.org.
And that's all for episode 33. We'll be back next week when we'll be discussing our Thing Explainer competition. Yes, a competition that you can enter. And we'll bring you some command line love and go over all your feedback.
Wow.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us, Emma. You're going to come back next week.
Thank you. I will be here.
Sweet. Excellent. Wow. Oh,
smooth as silk. No one would ever have known.
Ever have known what, Alan? I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, cut that bit out.
So, Emma, are you going to tell us about what's in the System 76 secret lab? Because Ryan was rubbish at answering that question.
I heard him talking about it, and it's a secret. I was like, oh, my God. For one, I'm mad that he got to go in there and even see what's going on. For two, he knows about something that I don't. And for three, why does he get privilege? I don't get it.